So the topic that I'll actually be talking about today is evolution of cataclysmic variables. And actually what I'm going to try and do is talk about two strands of research I've been involved in there recently that's coming at this problem really from two different angles. And the first strand is going to be about how we can try and overcome selection biases, which I think have really plagued virtually every existing comparison of theoretical predictions and observational data in this field, to an extent that I hope I'll try and convince you is really, really very poor and very bad. It means that we probably have very little clue at the moment, or have had very little clue about really whether the models we have work or not. And so I'll try and show you how we try to overcome this. And the second strand will be about essentially moving beyond that and trying to construct new, better, hopefully, recipes for the evolution of these binaries, and to do that by using a completely new tool, which is actually by focusing for once on the donor star properties in these systems. So instead of using things like accretion luminosity or something, we're trying to really exploit the fact that the donor stars in these systems can be used as tracers of the evolutionary state of this binary. And so those are the two strands, which hopefully will kind of somehow magically merge as I'll go on. So this is a... Lars told me that I should probably, at some point you sort of mentioned that the introductions can be short here because people all kind of know what you're roughly talking about. So this is going to be a... Well, I don't care. I have no time to spend time on this slide. So briefly, this is a cataclysmic variable. I suspect most of you will have seen a slide something like this before. So very briefly, what we're talking about is something that has a white dwarf primary. It's an interacting semi-detached binary. Has a main sequence secondary star, or at least roughly main sequence. The secondary star is undergoing Roche lobe overflow, so it's losing mass to the white dwarf, which accretes it usually via a disk. And the orbital periods of these systems are sort of conveniently in the range of a few hours or thereabouts, which makes them great also for observational studies. It means you can trace the full orbits of these systems and study accretion on those timescales. But the kind of things to drive home here is I'm really not going to spend hardly any time at all trying to motivate why we should be interested in these systems. I'm assuming most of you have some idea. The only thing I'll really say about that is, first of all, that these things are one of the two probable interesting channels by which we can make type 1a supernovae. So if I chuck enough mass onto this white dwarf primary during a Hubble time, in a CV, then that might be one way of making this thing go boom. And another point to just kind of stress right from the outset is that the mass transfer and evolution in CVs is driven essentially exclusively by angular momentum losses. So when I say I'm interested in the evolution of these interacting binaries, really what I'm saying is I'm interested in figuring out how these angular momentum loss mechanisms actually work. And that's another, actually, sort of, I'm saying this kind of by way of motivating this a little bit as well, because the same processes that are relevant here, and the processes that we're talking about here are basically two, namely magnetic braking, which is that this secondary star might have a magnetic stellar wind coming from it, and as it loses mass in this magnetic stellar wind, this carries away with it angular momentum, and that's quite a fast way of losing angular momentum. And then the other way is simply gravitational radiation, which every closed binary, of course, suffers from, and therefore both of these things are ways of losing angular momentum. So these two angular momentum loss mechanisms are entirely responsible for driving mass transfer and evolution in CVs. So CVs would not be semi-detached if it weren't for these things, angular momentum loss mechanisms. But the other reason that's important is because if we can understand these mechanisms in CVs, they obviously have implications for all sorts of other things. So magnetic braking, for example, is the same mechanism that spins down stars, single stars even. Virtually every kind of closed binary you know about, their distributions in orbital period space, for example, will be strongly affected by all these mechanisms. So there is implications of trying to understand the evolution of these objects well beyond just the CVs. So these two things are really all I'll say about the motivation for trying to study this beyond the immediate CV context. And then the last point to make right from the outset is that CV evolution, at least initially, and I'll that become more clear in a minute, drives a system from long periods to short periods. So CVs start their lives maybe at a period of 5-6 hours or something like that, with a donor star that might be, I don't know, half a solar mass or something like that. And then as it evolves, it gets continuously whittled down, this donor, into lower and lower masses until it finally arrives at very short periods, with a much lower mass secondary. So effectively, the evolution is along the main sequence for the donor star. And the point of saying this here right away is that this immediately implies also that the orbital period of a system is in some ways an extremely convenient and very direct tracer of the evolutionary state of a system. So I know immediately from this point that if I look at a system at, let's say, 5 hours, that's most likely a very young system, it's a young CV. If I look at a system at, I don't know, 2 hours, that's probably a very old CV with a low mass secondary. So that's an important point. And in fact, this is the point why, when we study evolution of CVs observationally, most of that work, at least up to date, has focused on studying the evolution, the orbital period distribution of the CVs we know, because the orbital period is such a direct tracer, and in fact, orbital periods are really the one thing that we can measure very precisely observationally about virtually every single of these systems, much more precisely than virtually every other tracer that we have, possibly with one exception that I'll come to later. So here is the orbital period distribution of CVs. This is what we're trying. This is the name of the game, trying to understand how this distribution comes about. This is what theoretical models for CV evolution are trying to understand and explain. And the thing to note here right from the outset is, so we're looking at just number of systems against orbital period. You see immediately there's a really clear gap between an orbital period of about 2 and 3 hours. This is the well-known, famous CV period gap. It's been known for a long time. This is quite a recent version of this diagram, but diagrams like this have been around for a long time. It's well known that this gap has existed for 20 years or more. So we know that this is a real effect. And it's really this period gap, above all, that has driven the development of what I would call the standard model of CV evolution, trying to understand why we have this. So again, in the context of systems evolving from long to short periods, it means there's something going on when they reach 3 hours. Something happens. Now, it was noted really quite early on that this 2 to 3 hours corresponds to donor stars in the systems having masses of around 0.2, 0.3 solar masses or so. And it was noted then that this was just right around the masses where you'd expect late type main sequence stars to become fully convective, so where they lose their radiative core completely. And again, trying to sort of figure out then what that might imply, or might that hang together with the period gap, the standard model basically sort of just intuitively came out of this idea that this looks like there must be some sort of change at 3 hours in the dominant angular momentum loss mechanism that drives the evolution. And so essentially what came out of this was the standard model saying, well, okay, let's say above the gap we have a donor which has a radiative core which has masses in excess of 0.2, 0.3 solar masses. At that point, this should definitely have this strong magnetic wind that I was talking about. Magnetic braking should be active, should drive quite fast angular momentum loss, and therefore quite high mass transfer rates in these systems. The donors then would reach, or the systems would reach 3 hours. At this point, the donors would become fully convective. And the standard model basically said, aha, so what will happen at this point is there's no more radiative core. Magnetic fields in many dynamo models are anchored in the transition region between the convection zone and the radiative core. So at that point, presumably, magnetic braking will magically stop because there's no more magnetic field, perhaps. And if that's true, then we would have no more magnetic braking. Now, these donors above the gap are driven slightly out of thermal equilibrium, not badly so, but a little bit. So they tend to be a little bit oversized. So once you take magnetic braking away, they'll shrink back into their Roche lobe. And basically what happens then in the standard model, you say that, okay, so this happens at 3 hours. So at that point, all that's left to drive the evolution of these systems is just pure GR, gravitational radiation. And what will happen is then that the system will detach at 3 hours, will evolve through the gap as a detached system solely under the action of gravitational radiation. It'll come out at the bottom of the gap when gravitational radiation actually drives the Roche lobe back into contact with the secondary star. And at that point, it restarts its life as a CV, but now as a CV, which again is purely driven by GR, which is a much slower angular momentum loss mechanism than magnetic braking is, and therefore drives much lower mass transfer rates. And so then the system evolves through this region between about 75 minutes and 2 hours. reaches this minimum period, which is the other interesting feature in the Fourier distribution. There seems to be a very sharp cutoff around 75 minutes. And the way we understand this is that once the donor has become such low mass that it's now effectively a brown dwarf-like object, such objects, as I'm sure you know, respond differently to mass loss than do normal main sequence stars. If you take mass away from them, they try to expand. And what that means in terms of evolution is they evolve back towards longer periods beyond the minimum period. And so we call such objects that bounce back from here, we call colloquially period bouncers. And so these are objects effectively with brown dwarf secondaries or brown dwarf-like secondaries. Who knows what exactly those donors actually are. This is the standard model of CV evolution. So CVs, there's essentially no CVs here except those that are born in here, which can happen. But in general, a CV will start life here. Magnetic braking takes it 2-3 hours, goes a detached system through the gap, gravitational radiation drives it from the lower gap to the minimum period, and then back with a brown dwarf-like donor back towards longer periods.
The standard model makes some statements about the split between pre-bounce, post-bounce.
We'll come to that in just a second, in fact. So this is the standard, this is sort of how, this distribution is basically why the standard model came to be. Keep that in mind, right? So this standard model came about in order to explain this. So there's things like this, things like saying the magnetic braking shuts off magically. I mean, this is kind of, it's a plausibility argument. There's not much more behind it than that, and I'm sure there might be questions about that later. So right, I'm not saying I believe this, but this is what we have.
I had heard in a previous talk that in the gap, it could be a white dwarf that has a strong magnetic field, and that's why it would fall in the gap. Is that a possibility?
I'll show you some evidence later that I think suggests that the basic idea, the basic skeleton of this model, so that there is disruption of something at 3 hours and then evolution has detached systems through the gap, that's probably right, actually, I think. The magnetic field strength does make a difference. There are some models which worry about that quite a lot. I'm really talking mostly about what we call non-magnetic systems here. It's a bit controversial whether white dwarf magnetic fields makes a real difference to the evolution or not. Some people think that they have very different Fourier distributions. Some people argue they don't. The magnetic ones are a fairly small fraction of the total population, though. So with everything I say, assume I'm talking about non-magnetic systems. So you can't actually yet, so even with the standard model in mind, you can't yet predict anything, actually. You can't yet simply take that track and compare it to the orbital period distribution. What you need to do, actually, is do a population synthesis study properly, right? So what you need to do, actually, and people have done this many times, in fact, you take a realistic population of main sequence binaries in your computer. You evolve them through the pre-CV phases. You evolve them through the CV phase with the recipe I've just described. You then take that, the output of that, and you predict from it the properties of the present day CV population. And it's that, of course, that you finally want to compare to your observations. Okay? So this is quite a lot of stuff to do, but it can be done. Here's the output from a fairly recent work along those lines. And what I'm showing here, I'm showing you this here in the mass transfer rate orbital period plane. Okay? So here is 2 hours, here is 3 hours, and here are the mass transfer rates. The color here shows simply the density of points at any particular point in this space. So dark blue is lots and lots of objects, green is a little fewer objects, and red is hardly any objects. Okay. So the thing to note straight away from here is that all the dark blue stuff is basically happening below the period gap, which sort of begins to answer your question. I'll make it more quantitative in a minute. But just to kind of set the scene, the reason for that is actually very easy to see in this plot. It's immediately obvious, in fact, that the evolutionary timescales of these systems are, roughly speaking, m donor star divided by m dot, divided by the transfer rates. And that means immediately that since the mass transfer rates are much lower below the gap than above the gap, the evolutionary timescales of CVs are much longer below the gap than above the gap. And that immediately implies you should expect most CVs to spend most of their lives below the gap in the standard model. So making that more quantitative, what are the predictions if I now project this previous plot onto just the orbital period plane and make a predicted distribution out of it? This is what happens. Ignore everything for the moment except the dark bold line here, which is the overall distribution. The key conclusions quantitatively that come out of this is that 99% of all CVs should be below the peer gap. Only 1% should be above the gap. 70% should already, in fact, be peer rate bouncers. 70% of all CVs should have brown dwarf-like secondaries. And another firm prediction of this model is that the minimum period should happen around 65 minutes. Okay, how does that compare to observations? This is why we all did this, right? Well, here is the return, the same thing I showed you before, pretty much it's the return cold catalog, now just plotted on a logarithmic scale. May look kind of similar to this, but keep in mind that the scales here are different. I'm showing this over two orders of magnitude, this over four. So it's already not looking so good. And quantitatively, instead of the 99% below the gap, we got 50% below the gap. This is not a factor of two discrepancy, this is a factor of 50 discrepancy. Right? We should have 1% above the gap, we have 50% above the gap.
What's the discovery probability?
We'll come to that. This is what this talk is all about. Yeah. We'll come to that. Almost no confirmed period bounces among, so this is about 500 CVs or so. And there's basically, as we know now, there's one strictly confirmed period bouncer that we know of. And there's maybe a handful of pretty decent candidates instead of 70%. And the minimum period comes out at about 75 minutes. 10 minutes doesn't sound so bad, perhaps. But actually, keep in mind that observationally, no question, we can measure these things better than a minute easily in almost all of these systems. And theoretically, it takes a very different mass transfer rate to make this go from 65 minutes to 75 minutes. It's kind of bad news. Which brings me to your point. Is this a valid comparison? And in fact, sort of, so why, you know, if this was valid, why would there be a debate? Why am I, you know, this standard model goes back 25 years. If this were all there was to it, why would we still be talking about it? And of course, the answer is selection effects. And everybody has been arguing about this for a long time. It's obvious that that you can't do what I've just done and get away with it. People have not really looked at this very carefully. I think people have been quite happy shoving this under the carpet a long time. We've been trying to look at this much more carefully, and the first thing we did is just to kind of convince ourselves that how important these effects are. We took the return cold cloud, the same observational sample that I just showed you, and we just divided it into bright and faint systems. And just said, okay, well, look, if selection biases are bad, the most obvious one is simply magnitude bias. What will happen? So here is the same thing divided into a bright sample and a faint sample, and showing you the two tier period distributions. And they are wildly different. Okay? So for example, whereas 50% are below the gap and above the gap, in the overall sample here, in the faint sample, you already get a preponderance of short period systems. So this is nothing, you can't really take this yet. I'll give you a reason why you can't do this to the return cold catalog really and get away with this either. But it just illustrates that you can't just kind of make this mishmash of CVs and kind of hope to compare it to anything in particular. It's nothing, you can't get away with it. And I say it's a mishmash because actually the return cold catalog contains CVs discovered by a whole range of methods. Everything from variability, x-rays, color, spectroscopy, you name it. And these are the different distributions for those where we have a pretty good idea what exactly was the selection method. And you can see quite easily that they're all quite different looking period distributions. And even within this, they're probably not really fair because they were discovered by different sub-surveys within this. So you can see straight away that you can't get away with just taking global samples and kind of comparing them to predictions. And really, this has been the get-out clause from the standard model for a long time. Everybody has basically been saying, well, I know there is nowhere near enough short-period systems relative to long-period systems in the observed sample, but maybe they're just really hard to find. You know, they are faint, so maybe we're just not finding them. And so people have tried to worry about discovery probability, but the only thing anybody's ever really done is basically take the output of a population synthesis and said, well, let's assume that probability of discovery scales something like a power of the accretion rate, because accretion rate kind of scales with brightness and, sorry?
Are there infrared studies?
No, there's no infrared samples. They probably would, but it's very difficult to pick out CVs in infrared as CVs. So purely by that, you'd need a complete sample of basically infrared sources and then follow them all up spectroscopically or something like that.
So Zeta wouldn't help, basically.
Sorry?
Zeta, infrared, because
because that's pretty wide field. It's good for this kind of brightnesses.
Yes.
And there should be huge catalogs where you catch them by accident.
People have done that. So people have looked at the properties of CVs in the infrared. Right. And it turns out they're very difficult to distinguish from other objects. So the infrared alone is not enough, and then that turns it into an enormous enterprise, taking you 10,000 objects and looking for the 5 CVs in those. Very difficult. So this is so far anything anybody's done. They've basically sort of taken the output from a simulation like this and said, well, if it scales as, you know, with accretion rate, then it'll be basically, instead of having 99% below the gap, you can make it sort of roughly equal. And maybe if it sort of scales as m to the 1/2, m dot to the 1/2, which might be a sort of infinite Euclidean kind of thing, then look, you can even make it, you could actually make more above the gap than below the gap. Now, I don't know. So, I mean, that's just, you can use this two ways. Either great news, right? I can make my static model work. Or you can be like me and think this is terrible. It means that our model has no predictive power whatsoever. We should just all give up. Because I can come up with a different model and do exactly the same thing to it, and it'll work too. So.
Quiet.
Yeah.
You know, there was the exercise carried out of class a little bit for a little period.
Yes.
Maybe you're going to mention that.
I wasn't going to.
That, you know, that's another way of getting at this problem. And we found no issue with standard model.
That's actually very, it's a very interesting point. So I wasn't really going to mention this. We can talk about it more later in discussion. But yes, that is actually a very interesting thing, and it's an independent constraint. I won't really come into it, but actually, there will be something to discuss, because what I'll say later is that we can't reconcile the standard model with observations. So something
which observation?
With two sets of this one that I'll show you in a minute, yeah. And also the donor radii.
Okay, but the t-effective data and the proximal degree of the standard.
The T effective data within factors of several, which is just what you need to make it to make.
So let me ask
the T effective for the white dwarf.
Yeah. The other question is, one of the big predictions that, as far as I know, nobody's been able to address is the where are all of the accreting helium white dwarfs that should be in these binaries. So back on that Hallowell plot, there were two facts of lower period. That's because roughly 20 or 30% of helium white dwarf accretors.
So you mean on, let me just put it back. Here. You mean this track?
Yeah.
That's not a double because of helium white dwarfs, I don't think. That's a double because of just, it is different white dwarf masses, but I don't think they're all helium white dwarfs. This is just.
Below the period gap, it's something like 20-30% are helium white dwarfs.
The ones with, like, well, in his thing, I think the reason there are really two tracks, I think, is purely because he's discretized them. So the reason why they're so distinct, I think. Anyway.
I think they're either because they also go to lower orbital periods.
But they would do anyway. Anyway, it's okay. So, but yeah, you might be right. So.
Well, I mean, the question is, where are the real problems, right? So.
Well, but how would you? I mean, so I would not consider that a serious issue, but all by itself, simply because white dwarf masses are tricky to measure anyway.
Yeah, but I think an observer can tell there's 2.8, 2.3.
That's certainly true. And there's no evidence of any 0.3 around at all, actually. That's true. So, I would consider that a bad news for the standard model as opposed to good news. So.
I think it's the clarity.
Yes. I think that's true. There is a selection bias there as well, of course, which is that systems of high mass white dwarfs are easy to find because their luminosities are higher. But that's a relatively minor bias compared to the bias between, for example, this and that. So I agree with you.
One of the things I would say is that you showed that how things were selected, and generally they're selected based on properties of the accretion.
Yes.
Right? And so which means that, which gives you a certain bias, which I assume you're talking about.
Well, I'll talk about biases much more carefully.
So whereas, you know, some of these things, they're not accreting all the time.
I'll talk about that too. Yeah. I'll come to all of that, because I think I completely agree with all of this, right? So I have no quibbling with it. In fact, my whole point of all this is to, so far all I've been trying to say is that
it's very hard.
I've been trying to say it's very hard, and I think really what I'm trying to say is this: that I think we've been doing a horrible job as a community of dealing with this. We've basically been kind of coming up with a standard model which violates at face value almost every single thing it's trying to model, and we get away with it by basically doing things like this and saying these are our selection biases. And they're not. I mean, this is not right, right? I mean, we know this is not right. CVs aren't in Euclidean space out to infinity. CVs aren't, this isn't a fair way by which we select anything. It's just not right. So I think we've been doing a really poor job. It's really my whole point. And it is hard.
You know what's needed. I mean, you need control.
Better circle. Even that, I will argue, is not enough. So I'm claiming that we just need to face up to this and do it properly and just work out what the selection effects actually are. And we have to convince ourselves either that we can do it and then we can make comparisons, or we can't do it at all. So we don't know how to model these systems, in which case we really should give up. But we shouldn't just sort of wave our hands around and say the standard model is or isn't right. That's kind of my point. So what we've tried to do is basically just address it head on and just do brute force and see what comes out of it. And so what we've done is take a galactic CV population predicted by the standard model. So we take one of these outputs from our population synthesis calculations, we take it as input. So for us, it's just a starting point. We create a simple but a fairly realistic model of the Milky Way. We distribute CVs appropriately within the galaxy. And we're actually the first time anybody's even tried this, which is kind of funny. So for example, we deal with the fact that old CVs won't have the same scale height as young CVs, which everybody has ignored to date. I don't know why people have ignored it. It turns out to be not an insignificant issue. It makes a big difference to what you should observe in certain samples.
Do you know the scale heights of the CVs?
Well, we know how old they are, according to the standard model. And if we know how old they are, we can look up what the scale heights is for populations of that age. So yes, we don't know what the real ones are. We know what the standard model says they should be.
Well, you really have a minimum.
That's right. We deal with this in a very approximate way. In fact, we don't even deal with it in a continuous way at the moment. We deal with it by saying things above the gap have a scale height basically that are fairly young stars, which is like 100 and something parsecs below the gap. But pre-period bounds, it's bigger and for the older for systems.
But I mean, the pre-CV phase
lasts a certain amount of time too.
I mean, it's not clear at all that you know the age. You know the minimum age.
Yes.
So the 5-hour system could be just as old as the 9 minutes.
No, the models do predict total ages as well. I mean, you can.
I understand.
They do go through this.
That's totally
right. I completely agree. Don't get me wrong. There's huge uncertainty. All we do is take the basic model that's out there and sort of fold it through. And I have no problem with skepticism as well. If anybody wants, I mean, everybody's free not to believe anything we do. My point is, if you don't believe it,
you gotta try.
Yeah, I would say if you don't believe it and you don't believe what comes out, then either you do better or you have to say we're stuffed, completely stuffed. So that's all I'll say about that. So then we actually go as far as create a complete SED of all these systems. That means we have to do a white dwarf based on Lars and Dean's way of dealing with what the temperature should be according to the mass transfer rate. The accretion disk, for which we have very poor models, I'll be the first to accept, but you know, you got to do something. Bright spot, which is where the stream hits the disk. Donor star, all these things have to be folded in because they all contribute to luminosity. Work on extinction towards each fake CV in the galaxy. We determine then the apparent predicted fluxes, the apparent magnitudes for every single fake CV. And all that is a ton of work, of course. But the whole point is, once we have that, we can apply identical selection cuts for the fake CVs as those that would affect the real samples. To anybody who's worked on external, in extragalactic sources, this sounds like they'll sort of wonder why the hell I'm going through this, because this is what you do, right? That's just period. That's just what you do. So I think we've just been really lazy that we've never bothered doing this. And the point is, of course, the resulting mock samples can be compared directly to the observed samples. That's what we're trying to get to. So we get away from this kind of, well, let's pretend we can scale by m dot and hope for the best. I just don't think that's good enough.
That's correct. Have you also studied the stability of your results?
Yes. Absolutely. We explore a huge range of things in dealing with different recipes for things and even allowing for different variability recipes and all kinds of stuff. I don't really want to go into details, but it's a long paper. So yes, we try as much as we can, but don't get me wrong. I mean, things do depend on it. The results I'll talk about don't depend on it. But Lars, I'm sure, will, for example, think that we can find other recipes that go even beyond the ranges we explored. You could make this fall apart if you really wanted to. So for example, disk recipes, there is really hardly any game in town for disks. Look at the age of this. The models we use are over 20 years old, and that's because nobody's come up with a better one. It's really not very good, but it's the best in town.
Isn't it also, the galaxy people can take an image of the sky and they know what their limits are in that image. Well, you have a catalog which comes from
I'll come to this. Absolutely. And when I apply this later, I will show you we will apply it to the one half decent selected sample that we have. So the one prop application I'll show you is to something that claims to be a complete sample, to a fixed color cut and a fixed magnitude limit. It's unfortunately a small sample, but better ones are coming. But just to show you how important this is, so does our model predict kind of the right trends and the kind of trends I showed you earlier? So for example, remember I showed you the color cut to Virchow and Kolb, you know, showed you that you find more long period systems if you have a very bright cut simply because the other ones are faint and don't make your cut. Well, we find exactly the same thing. So this is now our output from our simulation with a pure magnitude cut, VF 20, 16, 14. You can see they have a huge effect. Nothing. This is pure magnitude. No, we have nothing else yet. No color selection, no X-ray selection, no nothing.
What?
Sorry, yeah, I should say, ignore everything at the moment except the dark black lines. Everything else is kind of details of subpopulations. Okay? So you're looking only at the dark bold black lines. And the point is that this changes things dramatically. We've kept the overall scaling here, so you see how many more CVs you miss as you have bright cuts as well. You can also see how the ratio of the distribution changes as you do that, just like you'd expect. The number underneath is the fraction of long period systems in this sample. Okay, so at 20, only 5% are, which is still more than the 1% we'd expect. So this is 20. This is what we would consider a stupendously deep survey. Even there, it's already a factor of 5 higher than the intrinsic population. By the time you go to 14, it's 34%. So this is all kind of what you expect, but it's quite a strong effect. For what it's worth, this is not so Virchow and Kolb, as I say, is not the right place to go, but just as a sort of back of the envelope thing, the observed fraction of 50% in Virchow and Kolb would correspond to a limiting magnitude of 12. This is not a fair comparison, but it's the first hint that something's already wrong. Because Virchow and Kolb is bad, but it's not really a limited catalog that way, but even if it were, it wouldn't be 12th magnitude. And we know that because there's only 12 systems brighter than 12 in the entire catalog, right? So this can't be right. And indeed, all 12, interestingly, are long period systems. So first big hint, at least. This is not conclusive, but big hint. The standard model is not predicting the right answers here.
The model also looks like it doesn't have the width of the gap correct, that it looks wider in the data.
That's a very interesting point. I mean, this model here, it turns out that the width of the gap, and in fact, even the exact location of the gap, is something that the modelers can pretty much play with at their whim. It just depends, effectively, because you're sort of putting in, the cessation of magnetic braking almost by hand. So different modelers can kind of make this gap move around quite a lot. This doesn't affect much anything else here. So you could make a model that put the gap in the right place with the wide width without really changing much else. But it's true. It's kind of a bad thing that you have the freedom to do this, right? But yes, you're quite right. It's quite perceptive, actually. I was hoping to kind of not make anybody notice that. But yes, the gaps don't look quite right.
Why is this?
Why is what?
Why is it when you come to
brighter magnitudes you get more long period systems? It's simply that if you have bright magnitude limits, then fewer and fewer faint systems make it into your cut, whereas all the bright ones keep making it into your cut.
This is all sky at all latitudes?
This particular one is all sky. One of the nice things about our thing, of course, is that because we have a model of the galaxy, you give us an array and a deck and an area, and we will tell you what you should find there.
You could make the same thing as a function of like
We have done that. Yeah. In the paper, in fact, we have an in-plane sample, out-of-plane samples. And it turns out it makes a difference. And in fact, this is why I was going on about things like scale heights, for example. I mean, so we can argue about what the right scale heights are that we should be adopting, but what our model shows is that you had better worry about it. It makes a difference to your output. Okay, so this is now the one application we have, anybody has ever really had, for a real sample. It's kind of pathetic that it should be the Palomar Green sample, which is over 25 years old or something. It includes 27 CVs, but it's the only, at the moment, it is still the only sample that has ever claimed to be anything like a complete CV sample. Out of the 500, 700 CVs, 27 constitute a complete sample. It's really pathetic, right? Here's our prediction against the observations. I won't go into gory detail on the distributions. Key points, percentage of long period CVs predicted by our model is about 2 out of 27 should be long period systems. Observed, it's 14. It's more than half. Bad news. Period bouncers, so these brown dwarf secondary things, just as bad. Predicted is 5 out of 27. Observed is almost certainly nil. So really nothing here works properly. Yeah?
How are you modeling the selection things here, right? Because these all have to be like followed up to be confirmed as series and such and such.
The Palomar Green sample is a good sample. The Palomar Green sample was designed to model to find quasars mainly. And what they've got is a pretty well-defined blue cut, so a U minus B cut, and a magnitude limit of 16 or so. And everything within their survey limits that met those criteria was followed up spectroscopically. So you pretty much know that within those limits you have a pretty much 100% completeness, because CVs spectroscopically are easy to identify. Well, we hope.
The depth is about
18? 16. It's very bright. By today's standards, this is a pathetic sample, right?
It's even incomplete at 16.
It's about 50% complete there. We take all that into account. So.
Question. What's about self-shielding for the short period ones?
Self-shielding in what sense?
Yeah, let's say basically I'm not really a thin accretion disk, but maybe dirty systems which work themselves. Because the number here for the long periods agree pretty well with the short period observations within the factor of what?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, the absolute numbers here, we've just actually scaled it here.
Right. No, that was cool.
So the absolute number, basically what we've done here is to scale the total number in our predicted sample to that of the, so because it turns out that the space density of CVs is another unknown problem that we'd like to address with this. Actually, we don't know how many CVs are in the galaxy, so that's another thing. So this is actually a free parameter of this model, and we've just.
I guess you're going to put in between properties of the accretion disk, the scale heights and so on. If you have some self-shielding, it's a very new system, and basically easily get a large factor.
It's very true. I mean. It really comes down to the way we model the spectral energy distribution. If our model is horrifically bad for a particular subtype, then that could make a difference, I agree. At the moment, there's not much we can do about that other than to say that if anybody has a better model, we'd like to have it.
A little bit more.
So
sure. Below 2 hours.
Yeah.
What did you assume the absolute magnitudes are?
Well, we don't assume an absolute magnitude. We have a complete model of disk plus white dwarf plus whatever.
Yeah. But in quiescence, you see a white dwarf. And in the UV, it's mostly the white dwarf.
In the UV, but that's right. In our model, we find that for the most part, in a survey like this, what you'd find would be disk dominated. And that's
So the fact that you're predicted has a huge peak of short orbital periods tells me that you have a high expectation that everything you're going to find is in short orbital periods.
Yes.
In which case, those are predominantly white dwarf dominated.
No, what I'm telling you is that the model says they are not in the optical. And that's actually kind of borne out. It's not true that short period systems are dominated by the white dwarf in the optical.
If you look at the Sloan sample, the
Sloan sample has a limiting magnitude of 20. By the time you go to 20, things are different. This is 16.
But if you look at the short orbital period systems in there, and you look at their spectra, they are white dwarf dominated.
Right. But the ones you're thinking of here are just the very, very faintest systems. Maybe we're talking slightly different things.
What I'm saying is, if you're predicting that they're brighter than you expect, then you're going to get the wrong answer.
Sorry, I'm not quite sure what you're saying at all.
The prediction is that they're very bright below the period gap, right? And at first, you're going to expect to see a lot of them.
I think qualitative. It's very difficult to test this, right? Qualitatively, I think our model predicts kind of the right absolute magnitudes for CVs. I'll go as far as that, not much further than that. It's, for example, it's true that Sloan CVs, for example, some of them at least, the faint ones, are white dwarf dominated. And when I say that ours are primarily disk dominated, we haven't looked at every one we predict here, obviously. The ones that might be white dwarf dominated, for example, might be the bouncers. I can imagine that in our predictions, those would be white dwarf dominated. Typical one between the gap between the 2 and 3 hours, but not yet a bouncer, in our model typically are not white dwarf dominated. Keep in mind, WC the Jitty, right? Classical faint CV. That is not white dwarf dominated in the optical, right? So it's simply not true to say that every CV below 2 hours is white dwarf dominated. It's just not fair. The ones you now know and think of as sort of the typical ones have come out of Sloan and out of with a survey of limiting magnitude, 20, and hopefully are finally period bouncers, some of them at least. Or certainly come from like periods of 70 some minutes or something. So I don't think you would expect that in a survey of 16, most of the short period CVs you find in there, which clearly aren't period bouncers, even by our predictions, would be white dwarf dominated.
I feel like
you're saying that what we're saying is actually true, right? Which is that most of the CVs are, most CVs below the gap can't be disk dominated because you're showing right here that that violates.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying empirically it's simply not, even empirically it's not true. What you're saying is not true. Most CVs below the gap, pre-period bounds are not, I don't think, white dwarf dominated. Until you reach maybe 70, 75 minutes, 80 minutes. CVs between 80 minutes, Z-CHA in the optical isn't white dwarf dominated. HT-CAS in the optical isn't white dwarf dominated.
They're all selected in a particular way, right?
That's what we're trying to model, though.
That's what you're saying. I mean, if you take a typical 100 minute CV, which is below the period gap, at 16th magnitude observed, then most of those will not be period bouncers, and those will be the Z-CHA-like things that are still...
And they are observationally disk-dominated in the optical, and that's what
we're... When you say typical, do you mean typical as in for real typical, or do you mean typical as in Kolben-Ritter?
Well, it's not Kolben-Ritter, NPG. For real typical would mean every system is according to the standard model, is a brown dwarf anyway. So that none of this matters, right? But that's not the point.
But this you can easily test. Just take your sample yes. from the Panama and just say, well, yes. you overestimate
absolutely.
The brightness by 1 magnitude
yes.
or 2 magnitude. How would this picture change?
Yes, and in fact, we've done some of these tests. So for example, I believe we've even done tests in which we basically assume every system below the gap is white dwarf dominated. So we've just left the disk out. I honestly can't remember. I think the answer is in the paper. I don't think it actually made the model that much better.
Just would be interesting to see the white part. Don't use any model what you have for the white wall because it may be dirty in the surrounding. Just assume that you overpredict the brightness in your sample by 1 magnitude.
Sure.
And just basically cut from the observed one. Go with the observer for the long period to 15th magnitude and the other to 16th, and then you are there. Now, the question is, what would be the result? That would drastically change the result.
Well, we haven't tried that particular thing. That seems very ad hoc to me. I can live with simply saying change your SED and say that you know the disk isn't there. I think simply changing the selection cut is something that's so arbitrary that...
Yeah, maybe not arbitrary because if you go close enough, then basically the systems, the disk may really have an impact on the luminosity of the white dwarf that you see. It may be masked in the optical. Or look at this in the infrared, see whether I have a weightage.
Okay, you have to try to wrap
yes. it yeah. 5 minutes. Yeah, no, I'm slightly behind, as you might guess by now. okay, so conclusion from this is, anyway, our conclusion is that to whatever extent you believe our modeling, and you can feel free not to believe it, the standard model is definitely ruled out by this. And I pretty much stand by this. And I will go further than this. I'll again, keep in mind, our main point when we started this was not even to say that we're doing such a fancy, duper, you know, super duper job of modeling these things. The thing is, nobody's done it. And my argument would simply be this. If you hate what we've done and you think we're modeling CVs as too bright at short periods or whatever, give us a different recipe. The point simply is this. Nobody can claim at the moment the standard model works or doesn't work or anything like that based on these kind of comparisons unless you deal with selection effects. And unless you deal with it properly, you will never get an answer that anybody can believe. That's my point. And so I would at the moment argue that this I think we're still the only ones who actually even tried this, and our result is very much negative. You can't make it work. Right, I'm going to skip to the second strand very quickly because I'm slightly behind. But the question really is, how can we move beyond this? How can we get beyond the standard model? And what we want, obviously, really is an empirical recipe for how m dots or indeed j dots change as a function of orbital period. We'd like to do this empirically, not observationally if we could, not theoretically if we could. Now, you might wonder why we don't have this already, and because after all, we can estimate m dots, and this is now coming to something that Lars said, for example. People have tried this, right? Why don't we just measure m dots observationally from CVs, plot it against orbital period? Hey, presto, there's your evolution recipe. People have, of course, tried this. You can do it from accretion luminosity. Joe Patterson did this over 20 years ago. Note that there is a trend. Note also that the scatter is ridiculously big. I mean, really ridiculously big. And while these methods of estimating m dots are really poor, most experts would agree that this is not observational error. This is there's a lot more scatter here than we think there should be. A lot more. That's a big hint. I'll come back to that in just a sec. The second method is Lars's and Dean's. You can actually use the white dwarf temperature as a thermometer. It tells you how much mass you're chucking onto the white dwarf. Again, there's quite a bit of scatter. There's definitely a trend, which is nice, that above the gap we have higher temperatures than below the gap, and hence higher accretion rates. This may or may not agree with the standard model. The scatter is, in fact, quite big. It's hard to know how big. I think it's difficult. The numbers are a bit tricky to really estimate how much intrinsic scatter there is, I would argue. But it's definitely something one can do. So what's the problem? Why? You know, isn't this a done deal? Well, no, there's a skeleton in the closet of all of this. It actually affects everything I've said about our modeling too before. And the skeleton in the closet is that the reason we think there is such enormous scatter at given orbital period in mass transfer rates is that CVs may all be subject to very large mass transfer rate fluctuations, which may happen at unobservably long timescales. If you don't believe the scatter in the plot I've showed you, the big hint that we all pretty much agree with is that there is different classes at CVs observed at fixed orbital period. Classes like dwarf novae, nova-likes that never erupt.
When you say unobservably long, do you think it's longer than the classical energy recurrence time?
Comparable.
Why?
Because the, well, good question. Because the sort of only game in town at the moment for inducing these things is irradiation-induced mass transfer fluctuations. That model predicts timescales of order 100,000 years, which is kind of in the ballpark of nova eruptions. I'm not saying I really believe this. This model has enormous problems, actually. They've never, for example, been able to get this model to work properly at short periods. But it's at the moment, nobody has had a better idea. And the timescales certainly aren't observably long, which is nice. But anyway, so there's really good evidence that we need something like this to account for the big scatter. Because it turns out that CV evolution should be convergent. So all the models suggest that it doesn't matter where you start a CV. If there is a simple J dot evolution, they should all converge to this J dot M dot track very quickly. There should be no scatter in this relationship. And the scatter we see suggests that there's something else going on.
You already see on observable time scales that, for instance, in the nova lights, they go up and down by 2-3 magnitudes.
Absolutely.
Not that,
but even on
away,
that's right.
Even on short
times
of weeks to years.
That's right.
You see them going up and down.
So even that is a problem because
it is not very well known.
Yes. Why that happens, we don't know. But this is even worse, of course, because this could be. And if you look at something like this, the problem, of course, is that here, in these models at least, if they're true, they may not be, but they suggest that basically the low state of these fluctuations could be almost a detached state. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about enhancements potentially from, this is here, this dashed line you can barely see is, I think, the mean rate that they're talking about in this particular model. The state you actually would be looking at a CV might be this one here, because you'd never see it as a CV down here. So this could be almost an arbitrarily large enhancement. CVs you observe are basically, all of them could be in this unrepresentative high state. So they tell you nothing, potentially, about the long-term evolution of a CV, actually.
Well, I don't think that's true, because the T-effective would then be much lower. If the time average end dot is way down there, they're showing that little dashed line,
you're,
the T-effective is the white dwarf, and dwarf milling is above the period gap, would be much cooler.
I think we've talked about this with Dean quite a bit. The time scale in which the white dwarf responds, I think, to changes in M dot is on the order of 1,000 years or so.
No, but you can't hide the fact that that's a transient high M dot. So if you know the time average M dot, that's the classical limit recurrence zone, that sets the T effective.
I mean, classical limit, nothing here creates a problem for the classical limit because you're actually integrated, looking at it.
But the classical limit
does. Because that dash line.
So this is an arbitrary model.
For our classical node comparison, you're looking at an actual rate. You're not measuring M dot for individual systems. He's talking about measuring M dot for individual systems.
Yeah.
What I'm saying, the ignition mass is if you want to say that the time average M dot is very low above the period gap, the problem you're going to run into a lot of problems.
I'm not saying it's very low. I'm just saying the one we measure might be higher than whatever it is. I have not.
Did you take selection effect there into account as well? That the classical nova that you see may actually be the one, the few more systems that are in the high state, and therefore.
If they're in the high state for a classical nova recurrence time, then that would happen.
I actually think, I don't have time to spend too much on this. So my point, I will agree with you. I have no problem, for example, I think the classical nova stuff, which I haven't talked about at all, is probably the least biased by this stuff. The effective temperature white dwarf, I'm not so convinced. I think they would be affected by this. But can we do that for the discussion section? Okay, so the point is that most, maybe not all, but most traces of this stuff would be completely unreliable for long-term evolution of CVs, and that's what the game is. And by the way, so I'm not trying to kind of pour hot water on everybody's theory except mine. This would affect everything I've said about PG stuff would be affected as well. We too have to translate between the theoretical M dot and turn it into a luminosity. we assume that the long-term m dot is what we observe, right? So this affects me as much as anybody. So there is really a problem here, right? That if we think this is happening, then we're in trouble. So how can we get around this, or can we get around this? Is this actually now the point where we really should throw up our hands and say, well, you can't do this, you know, just give up? And I say we shouldn't do that. I think actually the NOVAs are one way of attacking this problem, I think, because they're nicely long-term. But the way we've been trying to do it is by focusing now on donor stars. And the idea is really quite simple, that mass loss drives CV's donors to be slightly out of thermal equilibrium, not much, but a bit. And it makes them oversized compared to main sequence stars. The point here is that donors now can only expand or contract on basically their own thermal timescale. And the whole point, the beautiful thing about this is that the thermal timescale of these donors is on the same order as the binary evolution timescale. So if you can use the properties of donors, more specifically the degree by which they're oversized, as a tracker of what m dot is, you're actually tracking the long-term mean mass transfer rate. Roughly speaking, the donor just doesn't care what the m dot is doing on a timescale of 100,000 years, because its thermal timescale is much longer than that. So that's what we're trying to do. And just to show you that fundamentally, qualitatively, this can work, here's actually a mass radius diagram for CV donors, first put together by Joe Patterson. This is my version of his plot. I won't bore you with exactly where these all come from. The small dots are short period systems, big dots are long period systems. The dashed line is the standard main sequence of a normal isolated field star. The points to take away from this is all the donors are significantly larger than main sequence, both above and below the gap, so the gap corresponds to here. The second point is, of course, there is in fact a discontinuity, which is really beautiful, and there's hardly any way in which you can introduce this into the data by hand. So you can argue about exactly how one constructs these diagrams. That discontinuity is almost certainly real. And that happens at exactly at the place where it separates long from short period systems. And what that means is, and this is what I was saying earlier, there's actually good evidence from this that something like disrupted magnetic braking is happening. It's just not truly disrupted magnetic braking. But something is happening at the period gap that's switching off, or somewhat switching off, the J dot that happens above the gap. Directly, I think this is the nicest empirical evidence we have that something like that's really going on. Okay, so I'll skip through this. It turns out you can use the spectral type of donor stars as well. They're later than they should be if they were normal main sequence stars, and it turns out that they're beautifully consistent with basically being later than main sequence, precisely because they're oversized, and that's quantitatively the two things match up, and I won't go into this. It just confirms that donor radii are reliable, and therefore the hope is that we can use the degree of expansion as a measure of m dot, as a secular measure of evolutionary m dot. How do you do this? Very briefly, well, here is our mass radius relationship for CVs. That's the shaded region. And what we can now do is just calculate a sequence of theoretical donor tracks for fixed m dots initially. So that's what the blue lines are. And where the two that intersect, where these intersect the observed mass radius relation, that's your first estimate of what the m dot must be at that mass and hence at that period. Okay? So basically, I can take a model of a late type main sequence star, I take mass from it at a certain rate, and then I basically just look at what its radius will be as it goes through lower and lower masses. And I can then look where that intersects the real track, and that's an estimate of what the m dot must be at that particular mass of the CV. Here's what that looks like when you then translate this back into the same space I showed you before, namely m dot against orbital period. And the shaded region here is what we have. Forget the lines here for the moment, but this is basically what we're currently predicting. This is kind of all still a bit preliminary, but it roughly it's probably going to stick.
That's even better.
Here is what the standard model kind of looks like. It depends, on people have slightly different standard models, but basically this is the standard model would be this line here. The real key point here is that we predict that mass transfer rates from the donor radii look to be higher than the standard model, probably at all orbital periods. But especially the gap here is particularly low below the gap, which is just what we want to make the gap objects basically evolve faster, therefore have longer, shorter evolutionary timescales, and that would reduce the ratio of long to short systems. And so pure GR is insufficient to drive the mass transfer rates below the gap. And again, that's something that we've suspected, but this seems to show this quite quantitatively. There's definitely evidence for disruption around the gap. So you can see there's definitely a jump. And so what we would say as a sort of physical Straumann model, if you will, so there might not be a total cessation of magnetic braking, but maybe there's just a reduction at the gap. As it hits the gap, magnetic braking doesn't stop, but there might be something like a reconfiguration of the magnetic field of the white, of the donor star. There's good empirical evidence you can ask him about from single stars that that might actually be happening. So there's still magnetic braking, just much weaker once the donor becomes fully convective. And below the gap, basically, you have this combination of this weakened magnetic braking plus GR driving the solution.
Can you measure the period change of the star
on the CD? Nobody's.
Because you might have two different M dots, basically.
Absolutely.
You should see, you can predict basically what yes. period change you would expect to bring the model up and then see how that is applied.
Absolutely. The measuring period changes as trackers of M dot is, as trackers of M dot basically is a, people have tried it before, horrifyingly difficult. There's actually, Tom Marsh has now got an idea for how you might do this. Nobody's ever managed it because they're probably because there's magnetic cycles on these things on timescales of 10 years, which obscure.
Anyway.
No, yeah, but it's very, very difficult. And now I'm actually finished. So the summary, summary is just that we have horrible problems so far, and I think, but so horrible empirical problems with selection effects, but we think we've got the tools to overcome this. The bottom line, I would simply say, is that the standard model of C-evolution is almost certainly wrong. I think both of these methods agree that the standard model is wrong, which we should talk about why your stuff doesn't say it's wrong. And evolution is faster than below the gap.